Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, 2016 CFO Awards. CFO of the Year Awards. The winner's list is small but exclusive, from managing the finances of multi-billion dollar enterprises to spearheading corporate philanthropy initiatives, these individuals are doing it all. And that's the headline on the front page. Then the articles about the winners are inside, and we will read one of those for the CFO of the Year Awards. The headline, Serving Company, Community with Passion. Lloyd attributes her success to firm's culture and leadership development. The Lifetime Achievement Award goes to Ann Lloyd with Martin Marietta Materials. Title, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, age 55. Company description, aggregates and heavy building material supplier. Birthplace, Statesville. Family members, spouse Steve, Mac and Sarah Lloyd, son and daughter-in-law. Drew Lloyd, son, soon to be CPA. Education, bachelor's degree in business administration, UNC Chapel Hill. Ann Lloyd, CFO of aggregates maker Martin Marietta, and the 2016 CFO Lifetime Achievement Award winner, didn't grow up loving numbers. Being raised by a mother in finance, finance was conversational in my home, she recalls. She knew about math and its applications, but love of business was anything but ingrained. As a child in Western North Carolina, Lloyd wanted to be a writer, a passion born from a love of reading. Reading could always take you to places you couldn't get to as a kid, she says. Little did she know that decades later, with Martin Marietta, she would be facilitating travel, just via aggregates laid on roadways instead of words printed on paper. And it was all thanks to one particular high school teacher and his Principles of Business course. It made math and finance fun, and while she had doubts, she almost majored in journalism at UNC Chapel Hill, she found her business classes inspiring. That's all it would take to funnel more STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math graduates into the workforce, she says. A few good teachers inspiring in the classroom. Early on, you have to be encouraged to explore every avenue or opportunity that's out there, she says, adding that teaching kids to take responsibility with their allowance is another great way to introduce business skills, as is teaching them to fend for themselves, something her dad did by making her build her first car, a Carolina Blue Datsun. That way she would know how to change her own oil, he said at the time. It taught me independence, she laughs. As the CFO of a company with about $3.4 billion in revenue, Lloyd has steered the firm's fiscal ship with steadfastness. Martin Marietta's operating income has grown from $217 million in 2013 to $479 million by the end of 2015. Cash flow from operating activities has surged, and for the first time in 3 years, the company netted money from investing activities. But it's her fierce loyalty and dedication to her job that impressed Martin Marietta CEO Ward Nye. Ann takes ownership, he says. She has advice for those wanting to follow in her successful footsteps. I think you've got to love what you do. If you don't really love what you do, you're not going to be the best at it. Find a place with people that can fulfill you and make your day happy, because you're going to spend a lot of time with those people. She says you need to like the people you work with and the values of your company, because life is way too short to sacrifice in any one of those things. Describe what makes you a successful CFO. A successful CFO has to understand the necessity to build a talented team of individuals with diverse skills and opinions, all working toward a unified goal to create a culture that values differences of opinion and to fully understand the operations that drive your business. My success has been built on the ability to build and lead great teams for a great company with a great culture. How did you contribute to your organization's growth? Martin Marietta has tripled its revenues since I joined the company in 1998. Key contributions have been maintaining a dynamic capital structure and developing a scalable infrastructure, both to support growth. However, my most rewarding contribution is in partnering with Ward Nye, our CEO, to develop long-term strategic plans to drive growth and to see those plans take shape and become reality. What's the greatest obstacle or challenge you faced in your career? I don't tend to dwell on obstacles or challenges that are behind me. I'm usually looking ahead for opportunities to apply the lessons I've learned from those very obstacles and challenges. However, the greatest obstacle or challenge you face is often in your own self-doubt, the questions you ask yourself at 2 a.m. Have I considered all the risks? Did I make the right decision? Do I have the right team? What's one thing you wish people understood better about the role of the CFO? Most people think of CFOs and finance professionals in general as numbers people. And we do like numbers, but not just for the sake of numbers. Both the history and the future of a company can often be found in the numbers. However, CFOs have to rise above the numbers and look for risk, peer around corners to see what's coming, lay a foundation for the future, and expect and plan for the unexpected. What civic organizations are you involved with and how do you serve them? I am involved in a number of civic and community organizations in principally financial-related roles. I find I do my best work in an organization that matches my passion with my skill set. Most recently, I completed my tenure as chair of the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce. I'm proud of the work of the North Carolina Chamber and am humbled to be a part of such a dynamic group of business leaders who all have only the best interests of the state of North Carolina in mind. Who would you consider as your mentor? As I move through my career, I've had many mentors who served as guideposts, guardrails, and sounding boards. However, most consistently, my parents, Mickey and Dixie Harris, have been the mentors who always point me toward true north. What are some of your favorite activities outside work? There is no better day than one spent near a beach surrounded by family and friends with a not-so-friendly cornhole competition thrown in. But a close second is a UNC Tar Heel college football Saturday. What is the best piece of advice you've ever received? Understand the most important objective of every day, regardless of a business or personal nature, and accomplish that objective. If you had to choose another career, what would it be? A toss-up between writing great novels and being a chef depends on the day. If Hollywood were going to make a movie about your company, who would you want to play you? I can't even imagine whom this would be, but if I had to choose, how about Helen Mirren? She's a brilliant actress. She takes on strong roles in a fearless manner. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings. The first headline, lawyer waits and waits for state to finalize deal. And this is written by digital producer Mark DeRoberts. Raleigh lawyer and state representative Dwayne Hall is hoping that the tomato plants that he's already planted outside the historic Bailey Tucker House on Lane Street will be ripe and ready by the time he finishes buying the building, and not rotten. Hall's offer to buy the property was approved by Council of State in April, but the deal has yet to be finalized. The two-story house, built in 1917, was formerly used as a guest house for visiting dignitaries to the North Carolina Executive Mansion across the street, or for governors needing residence during the mansion's many renovation projects through the years. The wheels turn slow in state government, he quipped. Hall says the state has given him a key to the house already, so he can start some cleanup and renovation, but he won't be able to begin moving his two-person shop into the house until probably the fall. Hall will be joined by a couple of other Raleigh lawyers who will be leasing rooms in the house, including entertainment lawyer Gus Gussler, who's also owner of the Players Retreat restaurant and bar in Raleigh. Hall is paying $900,000 for the two-story house. Andrews hams it up at the Royal Box. Well done, not only to Wimbledon ladies doubles champs Serena Williams and Venus Williams, but to Raleigh's own Andy Andrews. Andrews, the CEO of Dominion Realty Partners, who also happens to be the executive vice president of the United States Tennis Association, was in the Royal Box during the women's doubles finals match. He watched with none other than the Duke of Kent, who is known as Prince Edward, grandchild of King George V, when Wimbledon is not on in England. As for Andrews, no photobomb needed here. He was there front and center and was loving it. And that's concerning a picture of a crowd with Andy Andrews and also the Williams sisters accepting their trophies. Former head of PNC's local ops bids adieu, heads west. Some news on a former Triangle executive that many in the local business community would recognize. Only 2 years after succeeding Bill Mills as PNC Bank's regional president for Philadelphia, Delaware, and southern New Jersey, Paula Freiland retired from the bank July 8. The bank said Freiland's retirement at age 58 was precipitated by plans to relocate to a home in the western portion of the U.S. The departure of Freiland was a surprise to banking observers. She had worked in the Philadelphia area for the Pittsburgh-based bank for a long period of time, since 1990, before being tapped in 2012 to head up the bank's Eastern North Carolina and Raleigh operations after PNC bought RBC Bank's U.S. operations. Duke Swadwa signs with Carnegie Mellon as fellow. Entrepreneurial activist Vivek Wadhwa, who lived in Raleigh for many years, has joined Carnegie Mellon University's engineering school. Wadhwa will serve as a distinguished fellow and professor teaching classes and researching technologies from the Pittsburgh University's Silicon Valley campus. CMU is doing some of the most advanced research in areas such as robotics, artificial intelligence, Internet of Things, autonomous cars, and almost every field of engineering and bioengineering, he says. This will provide me direct access to the amazing faculty and enable me to help them make a much greater impact on the world. Wadhwa will stay with Duke University until the end of the year, when his 12-year term ends as adjunct professor, and thank the Durham University for years of collaboration. They helped me transition from a tech entrepreneur to an academic, well, at least on the surface, he said in an email. Startup fights smelly feet. The Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill students who last year teamed up on Carpe Lotion, a product aimed at making your hands less sweaty, have now collaborated to combat perspiration on another body part, your feet. Duke's Casper Kubica and UNC's David Spratt, who met through the Robertson Scholars Program 2 years ago, have launched what they're calling Carpe Foot Lotion. Anybody who wears shoes has likely experienced sweaty, smelly feet at some point, Spratt said, and he's betting folks will pay $14.95 to fight the issue. After all, investors have already gambled serious cash on the company. The team received a $100,000 infusion last year from Durham-based Bootstrap Advisors, a firm with a history of backing quirky products such as dog anxiety wrap Thundershirt. And in a section called Quotable, Taste of English Soccer, the quote, "Most of the time in London, you get in a lift and everyone puts their head down and no one talks to you. Here, by the time you get up to the third floor, you end up cuddling the person next to you." And that's from Mark Noble, captain for West Ham United, speaking at a press conference at the Umstead Hotel and Spa. The English Premier team from London played an exhibition match against the Carolina Railhawks and spent a few nights at the Carey Hotel. Noble and his teammates raved about the Umstead and WakeMed soccer park and noted the friendliness of the people in the triangle, and Noble's comment drew laughter from those in the room. The game, played July 12, finished in a 2-2 tie. The sellout crowd of 10,125 fans was the largest ever for a Railhawks game at WakeMed soccer park. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline: the other winner of the HGTV Smart Home 2016 sweepstakes, Raleigh builder Homes by Dickerson. With the announcement on July 11 that a Maryland mother of five had been picked as the winner of the HGTV Smart Home 2016 sweepstakes, a contest whose grand prize was a nearly $1 million new home in West Raleigh, builder Brant Chesson, president of Homes by Dickerson, says life around his office can start to return to normal. "Since the sweepstakes contest period was launched, we haven't had much involvement, but before that, we had been in a race since the middle of last year, he says. That was about when Chesson received an unsolicited email from Ron Feinbaum, the head of promotions for HGTV's parent company, Scripps Networks Interactive, and almost deleted the note. I thought at first it was a spam for some advertising or something like that, he says. But Chesson sent it to his marketing director anyway, who promptly confirmed it was legit and that HGTV was considering a Homes by Dickerson built house for its 2016 Smart Home Sweepstakes contest. We set up an interview the next week and rolled out the red carpet, he says. The network executives were also considering at least two other U.S. communities, including one in Denver, but it only took a week or two for the call that the Raleigh company had been selected. This is one of those trophies that not many people in our industry can put on their trophy shelf, Chesson says. We knew it was a tremendous marketing play for us locally and nationally. It was an honor to be selected. Chesson says his company is also on track to sell close to 140 new houses in 2016, or about 30 more houses than it sold in 2015. It's hard to say whether the sweepstakes had anything to do with that, because the market in the Triangle is pretty hot right now, he says, but this is going to be a record year for us. Target to anchor Chapel Hill mixed-use project. Developers of the Carolina Square mixed-use project on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill have confirmed that a lease has been signed with Target Corporation to be the retail anchor for the $123 million development project. Target will be opening its first flexible format store in North Carolina at Carolina Square, with a 21,000 square foot shop that's expected to open with the project's first building in summer 2017, along with Target restaurant operators for Pieology, a made-to-order pizza restaurant, and Be Good, a farm-to-table deli and fast food chain, have also signed deals to open new locations at Carolina Square. Hilton opens first Home 2 Suites hotel in the Triangle. Construction of the new Home 2 Suites by Hilton Hotel, that's been under construction at the Gateway Terrace development on Watkins Road in Durham, has finished and officially opened to guests on July 8. In Durham, each of the 103 rooms in the hotel at 3305 Watkins Road has fully equipped kitchens and modular furniture designed for extended stay guests, plus complimentary breakfast and Wi-Fi service, according to Hilton. A second Home to Suites hotel is also in the planning stages in Morrisville. Katina 18 to join fleet of new retailers at Morrisville's Park West Village. Raleigh chef and restaurant owner Jason Smith has confirmed plans to open a second iteration of Katina 18, the contemporary Tex-Mex style restaurant he owns at Cameron Village in Raleigh, with plans to open the new location in Morrisville in early 2017. Along with Katina 18, new food and dining deals have also been signed with Kilwins, Be Good, and Starbucks to open new locations at Park West Village by the fall. Walmart opens $100 million distribution center in Mebane. Walmart executives on July 13 hosted a ceremony celebrating the opening of its latest project in North Carolina, its $100 million refrigerated distribution center in Mebane. The 450,000 square foot facility is expected to create more than 550 new jobs, which is 100 more than was initially promised when the project was announced in late 2013. The Mebane Walmart Distribution Center will be the company's fourth distribution facility in North Carolina and will be used to store and distribute perishable food products for Walmart stores in North Carolina and Virginia. Florida developer of big retail centers opens new office in Raleigh. The Sembler Company of St. Petersburg, Florida, is opening a new office focused on expanding the company's base for grocery-anchored and other retail centers in the Carolinas, Virginia, North Georgia, and Tennessee. The new office will be based in Raleigh. The company is relocating Joe DiStagio, its newly hired director of real estate, to oversee the new satellite office in North Carolina. In the Triangle, Sembler is already a partner with Publix in the planned commercial development of Amberley Village, a 72,000-square-foot retail project at Green Level Church and Carpenter Fire Station Roads in Cary. The company has built or is building multiple grocery-anchored retail centers anchored by Publix, Kroger, Target, Walmart, and Costco in Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page in the Triangle Business Journal, and this is written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, Patheon preps for $580 million IPO. A down IPO market doesn't seem to have scared off Patheon, as the company turned heads July 11 when announcing a $580 million initial public offering. Consider that there have been only 42 IPOs priced so far this year, a rate 63% below last year, according to IPO tracker Renaissance Capital. In addition, companies that have gone public have not performed well. The Renaissance IPO index has returned a loss of 7.4% so far this year, compared to a 2.6% gain for the S&P 500. Patheon has given a share price target range of between $19 and $22. The midpoint of that range would give Patheon a market value of $2.9 billion. In recent years, Patheon has been on a growth tear. The company is helmed by Jim Mullen, formerly the CEO of Biogen, who took over in 2011. In that time, annual revenue has increased 159% to nearly $1.8 billion. Contributing to the growth have been acquisitions like Agir Pharmaceuticals and Gallus Biopharmaceuticals. The company touts that it has diversified the customer base, with its top 10 customers accounting for 38% of its revenue now versus 54% in 2011. Patheon contracts with pharmaceutical companies to develop and manufacture drugs. Revenue for the pharmaceutical industry was $744 billion in 2015 and is expected to grow to $1 trillion in 2020, according to Patheon, a compounded annual growth rate of 6%. Similarly, Patheon estimates research and developmental spending for the pharmaceutical and biotechnology industry to reach $160 billion in 2020. Other forecasts expect the pharmaceutical industry to increase outsourced work, something Mullen sees as an upside for Patheon, particularly as there is a growth runway for outsourced formulation, an area where Patheon considers itself strong. In 2015, the company provided development and manufacturing services for approximately 700 products and molecules for over 400 clients. UNC Rex expands urgent care operations with another express location in Raleigh. UNC Rex Healthcare expanded its urgent care reach July 11 by opening a Rex Express Care near its main hospital in West Raleigh. This is the fifth Rex Express, though the first in Raleigh. These centers have boomed in recent years as patients look for alternatives to the costly emergency rooms. They have also benefited healthcare systems, which can refer patients who need further care to their hospitals or clinics rather than seeing them walk to a competitor. WakeMed Health and Hospitals, UNC Rex's main rival, operates WakeMed Urgent Care very near Rex Hospital. The geographical location of the Rex Urgent Care is no doubt in part to capture patients and keep them in the UNC Rex network, just as WakeMed's intention is to capture those patients for its networks. FastMed Urgent Care, a separate chain of urgent care centers, has been growing rapidly and has shown that the urgent care model can generate revenue. The company has not released recent financials, though routinely appears on lists of fastest-growing companies. In 2014, the company recorded revenue of $81 million. FastMed operates 14 centers in the Triangle, including three in Raleigh. LifeCare asked North Carolina to approve 40 new beds. LifeCare Hospitals of North Carolina has filed an application with state regulators to develop 40 nursing care beds at its existing long-term care hospital in Rocky Mount. The hospital estimates a capital budget of $11.6 million for the project, which it would complete by late 2019 if approved. The small hospital is currently licensed for 50 hospital beds and has a medical staff of 40 physicians. It specializes in the treatment of medically complex patients who require extended hospitalization. North Carolina tightly regulates healthcare services, including these nursing care beds, through the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Regulators determined a need for 40 beds in Nash County, and LifeCare has applied for all 40 available. There are no competing bids, but that does not mean LifeCare will automatically receive approval. A public hearing for this project will be held August 18. And in a section called Big Number, $1.5 million, the amount raised by Durham's Icagen, a company that was founded in Durham and acquired by Pfizer. Last year, XR Pro Sciences, based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, acquired assets and talent from Pfizer and relaunched Icagen. And in a section called Quotable, the quote, Due to budget and programmatic priorities, IES and the Office of Outreach and Engagement did not move forward with the position. NC State University spokesman in explaining that Charles Hayes, who recently retired from a lengthy career as CEO of the Research Triangle Regional Partnership, would not become Senior Advisor of Economic Engagement at NCSU's Office of Outreach and Engagement, as had previously been announced. And finally, under mergers and acquisitions, optical equipment firm Walman buys Apex Concern. Apex-based medical device company iCare Alliance has been acquired by a division of Walman that makes optical equipment. iCare Alliance, which has 10 employees, will operate out of its existing 75,000-square-foot facility in Apex as a branch of Walman Instruments. And our first headline on the On Tech and Transportation page, written by Lauren Onosorge, Relias to add 450 jobs. Relias Learning, an online training firm already headquartered in Cary, is doubling down on North Carolina, armed with an incentive package worth more than $5 million in state and local grants. The company has pledged to add an additional 450 local jobs. That's on top of the 300 it already houses in Cary. At an announcement July 12, Mark Bells, chief operating officer of that firm, told Governor Pat McCrory that he was thrilled to receive this grant that allows us to stay home. North Carolina's Economic Development Partnership CEO Chris Chung told attendees that the state was adding what amounts to 250 jobs every day. "We're firing on every cylinder," he said. These particular jobs will be in everything from research and development to sales and marketing and administration, and mean an annual payroll of about $39 million, according to McCrory's announcement. "Not only are you producing a paycheck, but you're making a difference in society," McCrory told Relias executives, a nod to their mission of helping caregivers better provide services to the elderly. Company officials said they were still deciding whether to look for additional space. But if they do require additional square footage, that it will be in Cary, officials added. More than $22 million later, Silicon Valley firm with UNC roots shuts down. This time last year, MoveLoot, a Silicon Valley technology startup, was hiring in spades. It sold its customer list to home services firm Handy and has completely shuttered its operations. The company, which connected people to gently used furniture via an app, was founded by a group of UNC alumni and had about 45 employees in the Triangle last year, including folks working out of an RTP-based East Coast distribution center. The company raised $22 million. MoveLoot, which launched in North Carolina in 2014, has been relatively quiet about its closure, save for a statement on its website confirming the news. How a $1.4 billion DOT plan in Virginia could boost high-speed rail in North Carolina. A recently announced transportation project in Virginia is big news in the Triangle, and North Carolina as a whole, transportation officials say. Dubbed the Atlantic Gateway Project, the mammoth $1.4 billion build-out in Northern Virginia is aimed at improving more than 50 miles of the Interstate 95 corridor, from Fredericksburg to the Pentagon. And it's a bullish plan that includes extended interstate express lanes, as well as what has North Carolina officials the most excited, expanded passenger and freight rail capacity. The project means 14 miles of new rail track along the CSX rail corridor, including approaches for a new bridge over the Potomac River. The project even allows for ownership of the S Line, an abandoned rail corridor that runs from North Carolina to the Richmond area, a track that happens to be necessary for a high-speed rail plan that both Virginia and North Carolina have been planning for years. Joe Malazzo, executive director of the Regional Transportation Alliance, called it an extraordinarily important project for the southern mid-Atlantic regions of Virginia and North Carolina as well. The ability to purchase the Virginia portion of the Raleigh to Richmond high-speed rail corridor is the biggest development in high-speed rail that points north that I've seen, he says. The current plan would cut 30 miles off the trip to Richmond from Raleigh, he pointed out. Currently, to get to Richmond, you have to travel to Selma. Paul Worley, North Carolina Department of Transportation Rail Division Director, said the project will be a boost to anyone trying to get from North Carolina to D.C. by rail. And any capacity you build on that railroad also helps freight, Worley says. Any time when you can make some real changes and build additional capacity, that's good for the East Coast, he adds. And in a section called He Said, the phrase we use is, we like to help people be better coffee people. And that quote is from Brett Smith, co-founding entrepreneur behind Durham-based Counter Culture Coffee, speaking after his firm announced it was opening 4 additional barista training centers in the coming months, starting with one in Los Angeles. First turbine up at Amazon Wind Farm in eastern North Carolina. Craig Poff, business development director at Iberdrola, the company building the Amazon Wind Farm in eastern North Carolina, says his team has erected its first turbine. It's one of more than 100 that will dot a swath of farmland that spans parts of Perquimans and Pasquotank counties. To the south, Charlottesville, Virginia-based Apex Wind Energy is finalizing plans for a project of a similar size dubbed Timber Mill Wind that, if permits are approved, would be constructed in 2018 in Perquimans and Chowan counties. SideQuest founder raises money for a new venture. Scott Andrews, who founded Morrisville-based SideQuest in his basement several years ago, has scored more than $1 million in new financing for his newest project, InvestiQuant. According to a securities disclosure, the latest round makes the total cash haul more than $2.2 million. The company aims to provide on-demand research to stock investors. And this round, according to Andrews, attracted some of SideQuest's early investors. We will use the new capital to roll out our fully automated active investing strategies to the investing public, he said. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the small business section. And for the Small Business Watch, the focus is on Leland Little Auctions. The headline, Mastering the Convincing Voice of a Trade. Leland Little Auctions inks another expansion as business grows beyond $10 million. And this article is written by Lauren Hong. Leland Little Auctions first opened in 1998, leasing a former mill building in downtown Hillsboro. But the days of starting out and struggling for clients are long behind the company. Today, Leland Little has amassed $10 million in annual revenue each of the past 4 years. And recently, the company announced another expansion to accommodate the growth. The company operates out of a 4.5-acre location in Hillsboro, a location it has been in since 2009. Leland Little, president and principal auctioneer at the auction company, says the larger space would allow the company to build on its inventory and present its clients with more options. The additional space also will house a processing center, photography studios, and triple the amount of temperature-controlled wine storage. Upon the completion of the expansion, by year's end, the 21,000-square-foot gallery also will be equipped with additional offices. Little has always been in the auctioning business. I came to the Triangle and began this business in 1998 and have been fortunate in growth in the business and with the team, he says. The company's inventory mostly comes from the Southeast, primarily North Carolina, Virginia, and South Carolina. Like many other businesses in North Carolina, we sell back out to the world. We have clients from all parts of the world, London, China, Europe, and everywhere in between, who buy from us and we ship these items back to their locale, Little says. The company's biggest challenge is always in the timing. In the business we are in, we are always trying to make sure we have the best product we can acquire from local states and regions and provide the process to get the collection to market, he says. It is not all in selling the goods. There's always a market out there to buy the better bottles of wine, pieces of silver, and so on. It is filtering out, getting, and choosing the best that we can. As for the growth that Leland Little Auctions has experienced, Little says bringing in specialists from departments who are knowledgeable and can communicate the product with confidence to the market is key. Although the company started out with only one specialist, it now has 22 total employees with a jewelry director, wine director, fine arts directors, and furniture directors, among others. Another growth driver has been in its custom-written auction software. Little says the firm worked with a company in downtown Durham called Hewism to upgrade its website and back-end systems that house the company's sales, inventory, buying lists, and communication systems. I consider it, the technology, rather advanced in our trade, and we have invested a lot of mental thought and resources to it, he says. Little says for now, this 5,500-square-foot expansion is their final expansion planned. In 10, 20 years, we may do some other ideas and improvements, but this will absolutely serve the team, he says. The three-phase expansion process was done so we can continue to serve our future estates and cosigners with the best team and the best facility to house inventory securely. Little lives in Durham with his wife and two young daughters. He is an avid runner, having run the Walt Disney Marathon, and he recently ran the Myrtle Beach Marathon this past March. He currently serves as chairman of North Carolina's Executive Mansion Fine Arts Committee, Board of Directors, and the Executive Mansion Fund Incorporated. He is also on the advisory board for the Museum of Early Southern Decorative Arts. And also in the small business section, there's a column written by Amanda Soser, who is the founder and president of SAN International in Alexandria, Virginia. The headline on her column, Trans-Pacific Partnership Boosts Small Business. U.S. businesses face both exciting opportunities and growing competition in the expanding global market. As international trade becomes increasingly crucial to many businesses' growth, policymakers should change trade policies to make this process easier and fair. The U.S. International Trade Commission just released a report that showed that the Trans-Pacific Partnership would support the U.S. economy and U.S. small businesses. My company, SNA International, depends heavily on international trade. When I founded my company in 2002, we focused on forensic DNA management and consulting, as well as providing technological tools to help with forensic operations. After the nation experienced tragedies such as September 11 and Hurricane Katrina, we expanded to meet the needs of mass fatality planning. We brought our services abroad, even changing the company's name to SNA International in 2009 to redirect our accomplishments overseas. This expansion has allowed us to hire new workers at home. Doing business internationally continues to be essential to my company's growth. However, the lack of strong international trade policies makes it challenging for my company to compete with state-owned enterprises in the international market. In 2009, for example, we were competing for a contract with the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigations. We presented a fair price, but learned that we lost the bid to a state-supported UK-based company. The competition was not even close price-wise. The UK-based company came in at about half of our estimated cost, even after accounting for the high cost of bringing in its staff from the UK. In the end, the UK-based company did an insufficient job, and we won the next Oklahoma contract. But second chances do not come often, and the fact that we are losing contracts not because of the work we do, but because of an unfair cost disadvantage is simply disheartening. If things like this keep happening, we could go out of business. International trade agreements are a promising answer to this problem. They can help American businesses compete with state-owned enterprises and overcome other barriers such as tariffs. Fortunately, the Trans-Pacific Partnership would establish regulations on state-owned enterprises that will encourage them to be more transparent and not distort trade or put U.S. companies at a competitive disadvantage. By prohibiting unfair business conduct, the agreement will level the playing field between the United States and other countries. Now, Congress should vote to approve or reject the agreement. I'm glad that Northern Virginia Congressman Jerry Connolly and Don Baer have been supportive of recent trade legislation. I hope they and their colleagues will continue to vote in favor of international trade agreements. The world economy is becoming increasingly global, and we have no choice but to compete with companies in other countries. Trade agreements will make this process easier and fair. Once we have these trade agreements, it will help more small businesses like mine compete in the global economy. And now in the Business Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we have two Viewpoint columns. The first one is written by Judith Pryor, who is Vice President, Office of External Affairs at the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, the U.S. government's development finance institution. And the headline on her Viewpoint column, Innovation Vital in Emerging Markets. The 7th Annual Global Entrepreneurship Summit gathered just a few days ago in Silicon Valley, a fitting location for an event that celebrates the power of innovation to improve lives, create economic growth, and change the world. Here in the U.S., and especially in the Bay Area, we're quite familiar with many of the high-tech startups that have made us more efficient, effective, and connected. But today, entrepreneurs and early adopters are also flourishing in some of the most remote communities of the world. Today, people living in isolated communities in Africa are often the first to embrace new technologies like mobile payments before they have taken root in the U.S. Entrepreneurs in India are using small microfinance loans to build businesses, often generating enough revenue to create jobs in their communities. And when we look at some of the biggest challenges, such as insufficient electricity through the developing world, we see entrepreneurial approaches like home solar power kits being introduced alongside more traditional solutions like major power plants. Entrepreneurship connects all the world's people as both the source of breakthroughs that improve the way we live and work and as an engine of job creation and economic growth. And while startup businesses embody an entrepreneurial spirit, so too do many of the nonprofits that develop innovative solutions to long-standing challenges, as well as the governments that support entrepreneurs. This year's Global Entrepreneurship Summit, in fact, featured an entire panel devoted to the ways the U.S. government catalyzes investment in emerging markets. Two of the participants on this panel were partners of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, or OPIC. As the U.S. government's development finance institution, OPIC helps American businesses support sustainable development in some of the places where it is needed most. One of the partners featured at GES was Quantum ID, a small startup that developed a handheld cloud-based cargo tracking technology that has helped make air transport more affordable and efficient in some emerging markets. Our other partner is Root Capital, a nonprofit social investment fund that works to empower small rural farmers from Latin America to sub-Saharan Africa by providing financing for things like seeds, fertilizer, and farm equipment, together with training so that they can grow more food and connect with larger markets. Root has established an innovative set of processes to judge the credit worthiness of farmers who don't have the traditional collateral used to borrow money. With a repayment rate of close to 100%, it has shown that even poor farmers can be a good credit risk. At first glance, these two partners are different in almost every way, but they both embody the need for a variety of entrepreneurial solutions, not just in technology, but also some much older industries like agriculture, where so many farmers around the world still struggle to produce enough food for their immediate families. Today, as we look to support projects that will have a meaningful impact on people's lives, we realize that many of the best solutions often come from entrepreneurs who identify new approaches to old problems and identify some of the new challenges that our always changing world will face. These innovative thinkers and early adopters exist everywhere, in Silicon Valley, but also in sub-Saharan Africa, in the legendary startup garages, and even in more humble venues that may lack electricity. This spirit to start a business or develop a new product or service is universal, and its impact can be found around the world. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline on his column, Hot Home Sales Market Triggers Warning Signs. To say that the Triangle housing market is sizzling hot and has become a seller's market may be one of the biggest understatements of the year. June numbers released in the past few days show homes priced under $300,000 are selling in about 6 days in Wake County and in about 11 days around other areas of the Triangle. To comprehend the level of overheating, one just has to look at some historical averages of days on market for homes on the sale block. In 2008, the average days on market for a home, all price points in the Triangle, was around 120 days. In June, the average days on market was around 43 days for all homes. That should give all of us an idea of how the situation has tilted so favorably for the sellers. But soon, things are going to turn the other way. As we reported in last week's cover story, Triangle Home Builders are ramping up their new home construction pipeline, which certainly will add inventory to a depleted market. Additionally, the appraisal marketplace is beginning to show some warning signs. Several bank executives are beginning to wonder whether the price points demanded by home sellers will hold very long. What's happening now is after the home buyer agrees to a price set by the seller, sometimes the offer is more than the asking price. The appraisals are coming in substantially lower than the offer. At that point, the buyer has to pay the difference of the appraisal and the offer. And for a $350,000 home, that sometimes can be as much as $20,000. That forces the buyer to look for homes at lower price points, a sector that already is overheated. It becomes a no-win situation for most people, other than the sellers, of course. The median sales price of homes in the Triangle has gone up almost 6% year over year. Because of the low mortgage rates, buyers have remained aggressive in offering close to asking prices for homes because they know there are other buyers waiting in line to potentially make higher offers. For the broader economy, there is one good macro trend. Higher sales activity means an increase in brokers' commissions that would help the gross domestic product numbers in the residential investment sector. But these home price increases are outgaining wage increases, a scenario that will keep more and more first-time home buyers out of this market. In May, according to national data, the share of first-time home buyers fell to 30%, down from 32% in April. And that's another cautionary sign for the market. And now we turn to the People on the Move section, and the spotlight is on Casey Verberg, Downtown Development Coordinator, Downtown Manager for Fuquay Varina. As a project coordinator for the North Carolina city of Greenville, Casey Verberg says she'd always had an interest in downtown development. And though Verberg had a small role in the development of Greenville's downtown area, she now gets to be the ringleader of downtown development in Fuquay Varina, effective July 18. As the town's first ever downtown development coordinator, Verberg will work with Fuquay's Economic Development Department to coordinate efforts already underway to leverage private mixed-use development investment downtown. She'll also work with existing businesses to help them find ways of expanding while marketing downtown Fuquay Varina as a premier location to open a small business. Verberg will also serve as the town's downtown manager and will be in charge of administering the town's North Carolina Main Street program. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? I hope the downtown business merchants and citizens of Fuquay Varina know how excited I am about working with them on a daily basis to collaborate on great projects. What are some of your major goals for your new position? The town has been working to create economic development opportunities throughout its downtown that will recruit private mixed-use developers. I plan to coordinate and assist on these projects. Serving as the downtown manager, I plan to implement the four core objectives of the North Carolina Main Street program that focus on organization, design, promotion, and economic vitality. I am also excited about working with the existing downtown businesses to create an environment that makes downtown Fuquay Varina successful. Biggest pet peeve? Tardiness. I like to be early to everything. Biggest worry? Not being able to contribute to the greater good. At the end of my career, I'd like to look back and have something positive to show future generations. Triangle area business person you most admire? Ken Atkins, who was my boss at Wake County Economic Development. Education? Bachelor's in Communications, English, and a Master's in Public Administration from East Carolina University. And in a general news story in the Triangle Business Journal, we have the headline, Wake Virginia Officials Brainstorm Bus Rapid Transit Ideas. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. Bus Rapid Transit, BRT, continues to be a hot topic in Wake County, where transit officials are trying to figure out how to smooth future commutes in the midst of continued growth. And to figure out what BRT could mean for the Triangle, they're talking to officials who have seen it successfully implemented, such as Dennis Leach, Transportation Director of Arlington County, Virginia. Arlington, unlike the Triangle, already has layers of transit, including 12 miles of heavy rail, 11 metro stations, and an extensive regional bus system serving a ridership of about 280,000 people. And it teamed up with nearby Alexandria for a dedicated runway just for transit. In Arlington, a 0.8-mile stretch was dedicated for two-way BRT transit, with another 1.7 miles dubbed transit only in peak traffic period. Alexandria's BRT segment opened 2 years ago, with the Arlington stretch being completed just this past April. And we've already seen a pretty substantial increase in ridership on the line, he says, adding that it provides for a more reliable trip. Giving the bus priority ensures that a transit trip will get people to their destinations faster than the traditional car route, an outcome that doesn't just improve transit times. It also improves congestion as people opt for the faster transportation solution. He says part of what made the Virginia project successful was the stations and digital signs that communicate the bus schedules. Overall, it was a $10.5 million project just for Arlington's roadwork and stations. Joe Malazzo, executive director of the Regional Transportation Alliance in the Triangle, was one of about 50 local business leaders and officials who recently met with Leach in Northern Virginia to talk transit. He says Virginia's incremental approach's effectiveness was particularly telling, as there's a bold plan proposed in the Triangle, four BRT lines total in Wake County. It's likely that an incremental approach would be how local metros would proceed, he says. That way you could jumpstart services sooner, he says. In December, the transportation officials unveiled ways they're already trying to improve the bus experience in the Triangle. At the Raleigh Convention Center, they unveiled newer buses equipped with free Wi-Fi. We need to make this transit system look and feel different from what they perceive it to be right now, Tim Maloney, planning director for Wake County, said in December. Wake County proposed a $1.6 billion plan, along with BRT, would fund the county's share of new commuter rail. That plan called for more than 20 miles of BRT infrastructure, with the BRT bill coming in at about $347 million. And with our remaining minutes with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read some more from the CFO of the Year Awards. And we'll turn to the category of large nonprofits. The winner, Lydia Fuse Mason of Piedmont Health Services Incorporated. Title, Chief Financial Officer, age 57. Company description, community health centers. Birthplace, Dallas, Georgia. Family members, Lynette Fuse Mason, daughter. John C. Mason, deceased husband, who was best known as the Furniture Doctor. Rosalind Fuse Hall, sister. Education, bachelor's degree in business administration, UNC Chapel Hill. CPA license, Texas. Describe what makes you a successful CFO. Personally, my success stems from my ability to connect with people. I am a tactfully honest person. My message is consistent and I am accessible. I treat everyone with respect. I was taught, and I still believe, that we should do the right thing because it is the right thing to do. Professionally, I try to stay current with the industry changes. I strive to be at the table with our partners and or our colleagues to appropriately position my organization for the industry changes. I am a logical thinker, and I play devil's advocate as we develop processes. I work with a team, with a team mentality and a can-do spirit. How did you contribute to your organization's growth? I am just one on a team of many that aided the organization's expansion. My role on the team is to develop or analyze financial pro forma, to identify and contact the funding sources, and to monitor and report on the use of funds. Over my 21 years at Piedmont, our initial growth came from federal grants for expanded capacity or entering new access points, and our recent growth stems from entering the world of PACE in 2009. What's the greatest obstacle or challenge you faced in your career? In my healthcare career, the greatest obstacle is trying to maintain our mission to provide quality healthcare to our communities with margin of limited funds and a set of program requirements attached to the 330 grant that at times stifles growth and innovation. What's one thing you wish people understood better about the role of the CFO? The CFO does not own the goose that lays the golden eggs. We do not have a money tree in the backyard. We can only offer suggestions about how to make a better company, but it takes the whole company to make it work. What civic organizations are you involved with, and how do you serve them? PTA Thrift Shop in Chapel Hill, Carrboro, former board chair and former board treasurer. Empowerment Incorporated, board member and former board treasurer. Robert and Pearl Seymour Senior Center, former board member and former treasurer. BB&T Community Board, board member. Second Baptist Church, Chapel Hill, treasurer. Who would you consider as your mentor? There is no one person. I have different people given the area I need to think through. When I want to get tips on networking, I go to Brian Toomey, my CEO. When I want to get insight into healthcare finances, I go to Phil Harewood, former CFO and current CEO of Lincoln CHC in Durham. He was my resource when I started over 20 years ago. When I want to observe or get advice from a strong woman maneuvering in a male-dominated field, I go to Rosalind Fuse Hall, the current president of Bennett College, former secretary to the UNC Systems, and former chief of staff at Florida A&M. What are some of your favorite activities outside of work? Watching sports and movies, traveling. What is the best piece of advice you ever received? First, you have to get their attention. Then you need to meet them where they are, bring them where you need them to be, and finally, you either change the person, attitude or habits, or change the person, remove them. If you had to choose another career, what would it be? Math teacher? If Hollywood were going to make a movie about your company, who would you want to play you? Loretta Devine or Alfre Woodard? And we won't have much time, but we'll start reading another CFO of the Year under the Good Samaritan category. Heather Morrison, Media 2 Interactive, title Finance Director, age 52, company description, Interactive Media Planning and Media Buying Agency, birthplace Olympia, Washington, family members, husband Eric, children Rachel and Adam. Education, bachelor's degree in business administration. And actually, we're going to stop right there as we have run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast, and you can give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.